Welcome to Elevate Maryland, a podcast with Maryland focus and Howard County roots. My name's Tom Cole, and I'm here with my guest co-host, Annie Hader Shaw, again for the second time. How are you doing, Annie?
I'm doing well. I want to quickly acknowledge very quickly that I know a lot of us are reeling from this seemingly back-to-back shootings. And to be candid, it's been a week, that's for sure. First the shooting in Atlanta last week, which was actually happening just before we were recording the podcast with Erica. And then this week, the one in Boulder. I know I feel better when I'm with people. And I know that while we will be socially distanced, they are holding a Stop Asian Hate rally tomorrow at 5:30 at the Columbia Lakefront. And so I'll be there. These are tough moments, and I'd love to hear from, you know, the folks that are in our community that are trying to make a difference here too. And so I encourage everyone to attend with us.
Yeah, no, it's, part of, it seems like living in the United States nowadays, we are just dealing with cascading events of tragedy, often enabled by gun violence. But especially nowadays, these hate crimes that are based off of race or creed, there are so many forces working to divide us, and these are the consequences. And, you know, that when you have people in positions of authority that are normalizing words like the China virus and those type of things, that is, you know, violence is something that is enabled and encouraged, and that's what we're seeing. But on a somewhat lighter note, today I'm very excited. We have someone who I've admired from afar, even though we have interacted a few times in person, and that's talking about progressive land use policy. And maybe Casey wouldn't use those terms, but I'm going to use those terms. We have Montgomery County Planning Board Chair Casey Anderson on the show. And lest anyone think we're abandoning our Howard County roots, Montgomery County is facing and has faced many of the housing and zoning issues we're dealing with now. And actually, we're going to get into this with Casey, but they're also probably more progressed than we are, but in a general plan process, which Howard County is going through as well. But before we bring on Casey, I want to make sure that we highlight our third business sponsor. And if you just give me a moment, I appear to have misplaced it because we have one of my friends on, one of my old leadership Howard County classmates, and that is Simply Kashana. This week's featured business from the third is Simply Kashana, founded by Kashana Holland. Simply Kashana is building leaders through both a lifestyle and corporate brand, focusing on motivational speaking, life coaching, and training. You can find Kashana's business on Instagram and Facebook @LeadersMoveForward and on Twitter @LeadersMoveFOR1. And then you can check out the website LeadersMoveForward.com to support Simply Kashana. So again, leadership you. Kashana has served on a number of boards and commissions here in Howard County. She's a great leader, a great person to receive leadership coaching from. And so I hope you will check out her business. So with that, Annie, why don't you welcome our guest to the show?
Absolutely. Thank you, Tom. I'd like to introduce our guest, Casey Anderson. Casey Anderson has served on the Montgomery County Planning Board since 2011 and was appointed chair in 2014. He also serves as the vice chair of the Maryland National Capital Park and Planning Commission, the bi-county agency established by state law that regulates real estate development, plans transportation infrastructure, and manages the park systems in Montgomery and Prince George's counties. And we have a highlight list of things that Mr. Anderson has done while on the planning board, of which I'm only going to mention a few. He conceived a market-oriented system for allocating development capacity in downtown Bethesda to raise funds for urban parks, create incentives for construction of affordable housing, and raise standards for design excellence. Collaborated to create a bicycle stress map, which identifies places where less experienced cyclists need safer routes if they're going to feel comfortable riding. He's also utilized data to recommend the best places, best locations for parks and bicycle infrastructure. He's championed proposals to reduce minimum parking requirements, prioritize improvements for biking, walking, and transit, and incorporate vehicle miles traveled generated by development as a central factor in setting transportation impact rates. And he's done a variety of things, but one of the last things I'm going to mention is that he also helped shape plans for a countywide bus rapid transit network, as well as major land use plans for White Oak, Bethesda, and White Flint. And I'd love to see some of that here. And with that, I'd like to welcome Casey Anderson to the show. Welcome.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Yeah, it's great having you. So I want to start with the big question. Why is it that we cannot talk rationally about land use and development? We all live in houses. We've all benefited at some point in our lives from houses being built. But it seems like whenever the subject is raised, it's about greedy developers and neighborhood character. You've been at this for a long time, so I'm wondering if you have any insight on this.
Well, we talked a little bit before the show about my background in jury research. It's about understanding how people form opinions and about how they use filters or heuristics. It's kind of like that book, Don't Think About an Elephant, remember from a few years back, about how people take mental shortcuts to think about things. And in the case of real estate development, people apply different shortcuts, or they have narratives that they tell themselves. And one of them is the one you just mentioned, which is, you know, real estate development is all about greedy developers versus the residents. And people don't think about the fact that unless you built your own house as a log cabin with your bare hands, probably it was built by a real estate developer. But I think more than that, people have a lot of their savings tied up in their homes. They attach a lot of their identity to the place where they live, the physical places, and people have a hard time with change. And combined with the other things that are loaded into the choice of where you live, for example, access to a particular school is a big one. People get very attached and very concerned when they start thinking about the possibility that might change in ways that are unknown. And even people who have a relatively high tolerance for change start thinking, what's the upside for me, really? They can see the downsides. The neighborhood might be ruined. They might get redistricted into another school district. There might be more traffic. They have a harder time seeing the upsides. And I think there are some parallels to other political problems, like healthcare reform, for example. Why was healthcare reform so hard? Part of it was because if you had health insurance, you thought, well, my healthcare might get better, but I might lose it completely. And so the relative, you know, upside versus downside to a lot of people just seemed to be out of whack. And so it's hard for people to get out of that way of thinking about the need for this to be about all of us, and to think about what's good for the community over the long term and how they themselves might benefit if they took a chance on the possibility that change might work out for the best.
And so how do we have that healthy conversation? How have you found, and one thing that you mentioned there is that you have a background sort of doing public opinion research where you were working as a jury consultant and you were evaluating how certain messages resonated with people, how evidence might resonate with potential members of the public selected for a jury. And so the answer you just gave to Annie's question suggests that there may be a entry point that we can have a healthy discussion of development and potentially have it in a way that lets people know what benefits might be available to them. And so maybe say how you would see that conversation going, and then also what benefits people might experience from viewing development in a different way.
Well, I think it's a tough nut to crack. I'm not going to tell you that there's a magic formula that makes this easy. But I think that in my own experience, I live right on the edge of downtown Silver Spring. And this is a place that had experienced several, many years, decades, in fact, of decline. And redevelopment of Silver Spring was extremely controversial. But once it happened, it demonstrated not only that there was an upside, but it also validated that that idea in a way that was very concrete and was right in front of people's faces. So I think that there's a lot to be said for the idea that if you can get started and do something that's small, but that's concrete and real, as opposed to worrying too much about hitting the home run, getting the big thing done, then you can get people more comfortable. Because what is, you know, fear of change, a lot about it, it's the fear of the unknown. And so I think in the case of my neighborhood, I think there are a lot of people who oppose change, who probably today forgot that they were against it. Now they realize, wow, this is actually a good thing. We have a lot of bars and restaurants, places to go. There's more housing. Yes, maybe there's more traffic, but it didn't end the world, didn't degrade their quality of life. And they see that maybe the consequences are not what they'd feared. So I'm an advocate of acting as quickly as possible, even if that means it's in little ways, in order to, as proof of concept, to demonstrate to people and show them, you know, that when they experience it, that things might actually be better, or at least not worse than they were before.
Yeah, no, I think it's definitely an interesting way. And I mean, I got to say, I mean, Silver Spring has the Fillmore. So if you could, you know, we could work on getting a Fillmore here, that'd be okay with that. I'd be very happy with that too.
Well, all kidding aside, you know, that's one of the key arguments for more, you know, intensive development is if you don't have people, if you don't have density, you don't have customers, and you can't have the Fillmore. You can't have a restaurant. You can't even have a coffee shop down the street. And I think once people make that connection, that helps. And yeah, we've seen there's been a general trend in market preferences all over the country, especially in bigger cities on the coast, where people have really returned to the idea that, hey, living in a city is pretty good deal. And we in Montgomery County, we've had people in some of the places that used to be considered some of the most desirable, and they're still not in decline. But people who paid a lot of money to build a giant house in Potomac, who now got the memo that maybe it's not a lot of fun to have to drive 20 minutes to go get a jug of milk at 8 o'clock on a Tuesday night. So I think that we're seeing, and real estate agents, I think, will attest to this, that there's a shift in preferences because people are getting the idea because they see it with their own eyes and they're talking to their friends and they realize, hey, living close to the center of things is actually important to their quality of life.
So,
of course, that creates its own challenges.
Yeah.
The quality of life, and I'm going to ask you now about the sexy topic of public facilities. Because the interesting thing between Howard County and Montgomery County, while we're very different places, we end up approaching problems in a very similar way. And I'm going to talk about school capacity. In preparing for this, I came across your blog, The Third Space, which I really enjoyed. And last September, and this might be the last post you made, but the last September you posted about how Montgomery County's public facilities moratorium, and this is a quote, damages county's competitiveness and affordability, fails to fix school capacity shortfalls. Could you tell us a little bit more about the development moratorium that Montgomery County went through, where things are now, and how the county went about changing course on that?
Sure. And I think this also highlights another thing about making the case for change, which is as somebody who's studied how people make decisions and opinions, and anybody who's seen, you know, the rise of Donald Trump would, I think, have to agree that reason does not always prevail. And yet that's ultimately what we have to fall back on. We have to be relentlessly committed to facts and evidence, notwithstanding the fact that some people would try to create alternative realities that are more in keeping with the way that the outcomes that they want to see. So one of the things that we've tried to do is relentlessly focus on drilling down into the data and making sure that that was broadly communicated. And that's one of the reasons why I wrote all those blog posts. As you saw from the blog, you know, we were able to establish that, you know, we actually have a database of every school child in the entire county is associated with an address and a building type. So our staff worked out an agreement with Montgomery County Public Schools. So they anonymized the data, so we don't know the kids' names. But we do know how many kids at each school live in a single family attached house, in a low rise apartment building, in a townhouse, or in a high rise. And we're also able to associate that with the year of construction. So we have a comprehensive data set that shows where everyone lives and how recently the place where they lived was built. So we're able to show to the second decimal point of precision exactly how much school capacity needs are driven by new development, what kind of new development that is, versus turnover in older housing. And what we showed was that about 23% of enrollment growth between 2010 and 2015 was attributable to new development, which means about 76, 77% of enrollment growth was driven by housing that has existed for many years. And a lot of people find that extremely counterintuitive. They say, how is it possible that housing that's existed for decades, in some cases, is generating more students? And the answer is that there is a demographic wave that sort of undulates, right? If you think about the baby boom and then Generation X and the millennials and then Generation Z, the proportion of younger people in the population, school age population, relative to the adult population is not steady. So you go through a period of many years where the proportion of school age children is either getting bigger while the adult population is getting smaller or vice versa. And so over the last couple of decades, we've had more and more school-age children in proportion to the adult population because baby boomers were having children who grew up and had their own kids. So you have waves that basically go up and down in the school-age population, even as the adult population is increasing at a relatively slow and steady pace. And that means turnover of new housing, or rather of old housing, is generating a lot of new students because even though it's old housing, you're getting new generations of young families moving in, they're having kids, they're sending them to the schools that a few years ago weren't generating that many school children. And so that's a little difficult for people to get their minds around. But because we have invested so much in taking apart this data, we were able to show pretty conclusively, to the point where no reasonable person could deny it, that new development was not what was driving school capacity problems. And it's not just that new development was a relatively small proportion of enrollment growth, but something like 4% of that new enrollment growth was attributable to multifamily housing. And now people would say, well, even if it's just a few kids, you're still contributing to overcrowding problems. That may be true, but the important insight there is that a moratorium that stops new development, especially new multifamily housing, stops a lot of new housing units from being developed at the cost of, with the benefit of stopping only a few new students from entering the schools. So the cost-benefit ratio of a school moratorium, especially as it applies to apartment buildings, is completely out of whack. And we hammered away at that. We took apart the data. We were prepared to defend it. And a lot of people did not want to hear it. They said, we think your numbers are cooked. We don't believe you. And we were able to show this is not an estimate. This is not an educated guess. This is a very precise count of every week. And because we were able, again, to show that we'd taken every single school child in the entire county and associated them with a building type and a year of construction, which is an extremely labor-intensive task for our for our staff, but it was worth it because it assembled evidence that was basically irrefutable. And that's how we laid the groundwork for finally being able to overturn this moratorium policy, which I think was just tremendously counterproductive.
So I'm just going to go through an example, right? So it's like there are folks that bought their houses in the 1970s for like, I don't know, like $25,000 back in the days when houses were way more affordable. They lived in their house, they raised their kids went to school, and then they stayed in their house until they got a little bit older. And then they moved out. They either went to like, you know, 55 and up development, or they just moved out and I don't know, were passed away. And then those houses are sold to people with younger families who either don't have kids when they first get there, or they start a family, and that's where they start their family when they buy that single family home. Is that about right?
Exactly. And it doesn't matter whether they're living in new houses or old houses. The fact is they're turning over. And if you think about it, that's actually consistent with what you would think. And it, because people generally buy their first single family house when they're thinking about, you know, they've coupled up, maybe they're married a year or two, and then they save up a down payment and they're getting ready to have kids. And then, you know, 4 or 5 years later, you've got kids in the public schools. So this is sort of the cycle of life, right? And right, that's the phenomenon that I think a lot of people had never really considered. And unless you take apart that data and are able to document that, it's very, because people want to believe that the problem is new development, because then you can say, oh, the problem is greedy real estate developers. We just need to charge them more money and our problems will be solved. And they don't realize, like so many things in life, we've met the enemy and the enemy is us.
Yeah. You talked about the cost benefit analysis, because, and I want to dig in on that a little bit more, because here in Howard County, we have a public facilities moratorium, closed schools across pretty much the entirety of the county. And many would say, to your earlier point, well, I don't really care that much about older housing stock turning over and putting students in the school system. I don't care if older housing stock turnover is going to make schools overcrowded. I don't want another housing unit that is going to come in. And if the result of that is we're closed for development, no tears will be shed. But you said that there is a cost to that. So in Montgomery County, what was the cost that you presented to the county in terms of here's what we're giving up by enforcing a development moratorium that is based off of nonsense?
I think that most people recognize that limiting housing supply directly or indirectly causes a problem with affordability. Some people will try to quibble with you about that, but when they're cornered, most people will acknowledge, yeah, probably constraining housing supply does have something to do with higher housing prices. But they think about it in terms of, well, that's too bad. And yes, it's a social justice issue, but ultimately, you know, what's that got to do with me? And they might not say it like that, but I think that that's kind of a subtext to a lot of this is, so sorry to hear that, but not my problem. I think that one of the arguments that I have tried to elevate in this discussion is, yes, it is a social justice issue and we need to be concerned about that. But even if you're only interested in your own self-interest as a taxpayer, the failure to provide housing that is not only affordable to low income people or lower middle income people, but suitable and attractive to middle income people, upper middle income people, even relatively affluent people, is an economic competitiveness problem. And this is something else I talked about in one of the blog posts, that if you compare the cost of living in Austin, Texas, in Raleigh, North Carolina, and Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, to Montgomery County or the DC region, and I'd be willing to bet this is true of Howard County as well, the cost of living is significantly higher than those places. Those are jurisdictions that we often think of as being competitors for life sciences jobs, tech companies, those sort of things. Those are sort of emerging cities that are up and coming, and we hope to be competitive against them in attracting employers. Our cost of living is higher, and almost all of the difference in the cost of living is attributable to housing costs. you have basically the same costs of transportation, of energy, of food, of healthcare, whatever. Housing is the difference. So if you don't deliver housing that is not just affordable in the sense that we talk about, you know, affordable to people who are lower income, but affordable and suitable and attractive to people who have choices about where they're going to live, then the first time a postdoc at NIH gets a phone call from one of their friends from grad school and says, hey, I got a job for you in Austin, Texas, and I can't offer you more money, but even though you're going to make basically the same amount of money, you could buy more house. You could live in whatever neighborhood you want. You can live close to work. You can live close to all the best schools, all the best amenities. That's a problem for our economic competitiveness and our tax base. And employers are, I think, increasingly attuned to this idea that it's not just about where the CEO wants to live, because people who are in the C-suite will probably figure out a way to put a roof over their heads that they find not only can, for shelter, but it'll be next to the golf course or whatever it is they're looking for. But it's, you know, even at these high value, in these high value add type sectors like technology and healthcare, they're supported by a broad base of lab techs and nurses and people who are making a lot of money by almost any standard. But in a place like Montgomery County, they struggle to find some place that they can live without a commute that's really painful. They may have to accept a house in a neighborhood that's not quite to their liking. And while that doesn't have the same moral dimension that affordable housing for the poor has, it certainly pinches us in terms of our ability to compete for the best jobs and opportunities, which in turn builds a tax base that pays for social services, not to mention a high quality of life for everybody.
Well, that's a great way to think about it. You're right. The CEOs, they definitely don't have to worry about affording a place, but you're right. All of these companies and you mentioned healthcare, you're right. There's so much that goes into that. It's not just the people that are making a lot of money. There's so much that goes into every single business that, that has to function. So that's interesting. I'm going to ask a different question because, I think I've heard some chatter online about NIMBYs, people who always shout, not in my backyard. But on the other hand, I have noticed online, especially, on Twitter specifically, actually, a lot of YIMBYs, which is yes in my backyard. I mean, it's a pretty significant group of people, and every time I go online, I feel like I find more of them. So I guess the question is, where did that come from, and what creates a YIMBY, and what are the instigating forces there?
Well, here's a thought that some people might consider provocative, but here goes.
That's what we're here for.
The old school progressive suburban activism was fundamentally suspicious of growth and development. But it was primarily relatively affluent, older white homeowners.
Gotcha.
Today, there's a new wave of activism, which is sometimes equally suspicious of growth and development, but not in quite the same way. And that's the sort of new school of anti-gentrification activism. People are concerned about displacement and the impact that development will have on making it harder for people of color, for lower income people to find a place to live. So I would argue that I try very hard not to call people labels that they may not like, but the old school slow growth or anti-growth activists have been in some ways it's not that anti-growth sentiment or politics has disappeared. It's taken a different form. So in some respects, I'm optimistic that we've made some progress, and some of the race politics of the very recent past, the last couple of years, have been helpful at getting people to understand the degree to which the land use regulation has been an instrument of socioeconomic as well as racial segregation, not by force of law in the sense that it's, you know, Black or Hispanic people are prohibited from living in certain neighborhoods, or poor people are prohibited from living in certain neighborhoods, which is true in earlier generations, but they are economically excluded because if you can only build a single family house on a big lot, almost by definition, that's an option that's only available to people who are relatively privileged. So in some ways, that has resulted in a lot more openness to thinking about the idea that we should reconsider some of the restrictions on development, particularly single family zoning. In other ways, I think we have to acknowledge the fact that it's not a story of a complete transformation of attitudes about growth and development. And in some ways, we're fighting some similar battles, but the fault lines or the terms of engagement are different because of this concern about gentrification and displacement.
Well, I want to give you an opportunity to talk about the general plan for Montgomery County. Montgomery County's document is called Thrive Montgomery 2050. As I mentioned before, Howard County is going through or in the early stages of its own general plan process. I hate to make you go back to basics on it, but I think that the general plan is one of those things that people don't really understand what it is. And you can hear many different times like, oh, the general plan, and people still aren't comfortable with what a general plan does, how it informs other decisions. So if you could, please start with describing what a general plan is, and then maybe go into detail about your work in particular and the planning board's work in particular about emphasizing urbanism and affordable housing in Thrive Montgomery.
Sure. A general plan is a framework for other plans. It's really that simple. So as the name would suggest, it's written in general terms. It's at a 50,000 foot level, and it doesn't make any zoning changes, doesn't have the direct force of law in the sense that our master plans do. Now, some smaller counties will write a general or comprehensive plan, and that's coterminous with their master planning process. In a county like Montgomery, 504 square miles, a million people, we've got lots of little plans which fill in the gaps. So you could think of the general plan as just a rough outline. The recommendations for zoning changes and where transportation infrastructure is supposed to be built, specific zoning on specific parcels, that comes as those more specific plans are written and drafted and fill in the details. But the general plan of Montgomery County is known as the Wedges and Corridors Plan. It's been in place since 1964, which in a lot of ways is a testament to the fact that it was a visionary document. It survived for more than five decades, which is a long time. Most general plans are good for maybe a decade plus. So that's a success by any measure. And there are a lot of groundbreaking ideas that came out of that. For example, our agricultural reserve was the product of the general plans identifying the loss of land for farming as a problem the county needed to confront. And so several years after the general plan was written, the county summoned the political will to operationalize that idea and say, we're going to set aside land for agriculture and have a very complicated, elaborate scheme for how that would work economically, to set aside land for farming and pay the farmers for the loss of the development rights, et cetera. Similarly, our moderately priced dwelling unit program, which is still the leading inclusionary zoning program in the entire country, is the outgrowth of the general plans identifying affordable housing as a challenge that the county really needed to confront. So as we draft a new general plan, it's not so much that we're looking to specify the solution to every problem, but to set the agenda for the next generation of planning. And by way of example, in 1964, nobody was talking about racial equity in the general plan. Obviously, race was an issue. There was a civil rights movement, but nobody really thought about the direct connection between race and land use planning. Today, that's obviously very, very different. There wasn't a lot written in the general plan in 1964 about our economic competitiveness, because at that point, the county was growing by leaps and bounds. If anything, the concern was, how do we get this under control? You know, Washington, D.C. was still, you know, emerging as a major international capital city, and Montgomery County was becoming basically a bedroom community of that growing capital with some federal facilities and some employment there. But basically, the idea was growth management. And now we're in a place where it's not just we are answering the phone and saying, yes, if you'd like to build something here, here's the hoops you're going to have to jump through. We have to compete for economic opportunity. So that becomes a different context for the future of our planning work, is to try to figure out how can we be attractive to employers and continue to attract those kinds of economic opportunities. And while Montgomery County was pretty early to address environmental challenges and was responsive to the early environmental movement. And Rachel Carson, of course, is from Silver Spring, just a couple miles from where I'm sitting right now. So we were pretty early on that. But of course, climate change wasn't recognized as a problem in 1964. So the equity issues, especially around race, the environmental challenges of climate in particular, and the need to address economic competitiveness are, I think, the major challenges that we outline in this new document. And we suggest some pathways forward, like reforming single-family zoning and allowing more missing middle, more housing types, even in neighborhoods that previously were single-family only. The 1964 plan, like many plans of that period and many plans even today, says single-family zoning should be protected at all costs. We should maintain the integrity of single-family neighborhoods. It's like handed down on stone tablets. So we are writing a new set of stone tablets, and that will hopefully guide future work. And I always say, some people say plans are promises. If it's in the plan, there's a road or there's a school or there's a park, they say, well, you promised me you were going to build me a road or a school or park here, so now I expect to hold the government accountable for delivering it. I don't think that's quite right. I think plans are arguments. And plans are only powerful to the extent they're persuasive. If you read a plan and you say, wow, that makes sense to me, and I can see why following it would lead us to a better, more prosperous, more equitable, more environmentally sustainable future, then it's a good plan. The minute that the plan loses its persuasive power, you got to write a new one. And so that's the point at which we find ourselves today. We've had the 1964 plan had a great run, but it's lost its ability to persuade people to follow its ideas, its direction. And so what we're trying to do is lay out that agenda for the next 30 plus years.
I was going to, if you had any follow-up on that, I mean, the only other thing I will add to that is, or a question I will follow up with, is affordable housing. This past week was fortunate enough to have a editorial published in the Baltimore Sun about affordable housing. It is a very controversial topic. I got some pretty nasty emails. How have you been able to work that into your plan? And I wrote it down as soon as you said, I love this idea of plans being arguments and being only as powerful as they are persuasive. And that sort of ties back to a lot of our earlier discussions about having constructive discussions about development. How are you able to have the discussion about affordable housing in a way that is persuasive to the person that is saying, I'm most interested in my wallet, and that's where I'm done. And maybe you can't convince them, but then more broadly, how have you been able to have the discussion about affordable housing to say, listen, and I'm going to be straight up here, like affordable housing ultimately is a revenue negative for the county. If it's particularly for people looking at property taxes, you're more likely than not going to make much in terms of property taxes, income taxes off of affordable housing development. But we know it is critical to providing inclusive communities and also for the workforce housing that you've already described. So that's a long rambling question. That's probably more of a statement than anything else, but what would you say to that? How have you worked it in the general plan and how have you done that in a way that is persuasive to the people that will be considering it?
Well, I think we're saying a lot of things, this general plan that track your op-ed pretty closely. And I was very impressed by that op-ed. I thought it framed the arguments very effectively. You can take a look at our housing chapter and general plan. Let me know what you think, and we can, you know, compare notes. I think that in addition to this idea that housing is important to the workforce and our competitiveness, I think here's another one you might try out in Howard County. It's one that I've had some success with here. And that is that housing is infrastructure. You'll often run into people who say, well, I'm not against development, you understand. I just think we shouldn't have more housing until we build the infrastructure. And the point I like to make is housing is infrastructure. Just because it's built by private parties doesn't mean that it's not infrastructure. You know, just like we need water and sewer pipes, so we'll have a water tap to drink out of and a toilet to use. And just like we need schools to send our children to, we need office buildings to have a place to go to work, and we need houses to keep the rain off our heads. So it's all infrastructure. And the idea that we can wait to build housing until we have infrastructure, or say that that's a precondition, really misconceives the whole nature of what housing is. Housing, it's not accretive, to use, you know, management consultant jargon. It doesn't immediately, as you know, to your point, spin off more revenue than it requires to support. But really, that's not the point. It's necessary. It's the foundation, just like roads, water and sewer, et cetera, school buildings. It's the foundation upon which everything else rests. So you can if you think about it that way, I think it helps to at least get some of the people who are persuaded by the idea that you can have it both ways off their talking points.
I think that's a great place to launch into our elevator questions. Annie, do you want to start?
Yeah, sure. So I know you really got a blog. That's pretty interesting. I'll be reading that later. But what was the last book, movie, and music recommendation that you made to a friend or family member?
Well, I will confess to being a child of the 80s. And I'm still a metalhead. So as I was working on the general plan, I was listening to a lot of Metallica, Master of Puppets. And some of our staff even made me a T-shirt, which I'll show you the next time. It's sort of a knockoff on the Master of Puppets cover, except instead of headstones, it has quill pens pointing downward. So that's my music recommendation. Go for some old school headbanger music. It'll get you in the mood to write. And at least for me, it gets me fired up.
I do feel like there's an overlap between land use and heavy metal music. I've yet to fully figure it out, but I'm nodding in acknowledgement there.
As for books, I recently read Nothing to See Here, which is sort of a very hard to describe. It's a very funny novel about a woman who has an old friend from high school who's married a U.S. senator, and her old friend wants her to take care of her children because they spontaneously combust. And the kids are kind of an embarrassment to this person who's a public figure, so she's enlisted to be the nanny to keep the children from basically lighting everything on fire. Sometimes I don't know about you, but you know, like we were saying, Tom, you get a lot of angry emails. Mm-hmm. And so I find that when I have a little chance to do some light reading, I want to find something funny. If it's something I can do that's not just about learning more stuff for work. And you know, in the same vein, I really enjoyed High Maintenance on HBO, and which is a very funny show about a marijuana dealer, and it's really not about cannabis so much as it's about just all these people this guy makes deliveries to and all the insanity of their lives, which I really enjoyed after sort of a gap. I hadn't seen anything that I thought was really hilarious on television since Silicon Valley ended. So that's another one. If you missed that one, you got to go watch the entirety of Silicon Valley. I worked at AOL for a few years, and I thought it really nails the, you know, the tech bro ridiculousness and self-importance. So those are my recommendations.
Good. I need some funny stuff. What is the most unpopular benign opinion you hold?
That housing is good. And more housing is good. Yeah.
I don't know how many people would consider that benign, but we will accept that.
I don't know that that's unpopular on this podcast, though.
Not on this podcast.
I don't know.
That opinion is welcome on this podcast.
Yeah.
Your mileage may vary. I don't know.
All right. I will. So I know we know you listen to Elevate, but what podcast are you listening to?
I recently, I like the 538 podcast. I like the Al Franken podcast. Al Franken gets some great interviews. And 538 has a lot of smart commentary. One that I listened to recently, I just didn't agree with, but I think is worth listening to is Nice White Parents, which is a podcast, which was a series about public schools in Brooklyn and the efforts of affluent white parents to sort of, to quote unquote, improve the schools. And I think that even though I didn't really agree with the producer's take on that situation, I think it raises a lot of thought-provoking issues about racial segregation in schools. And, you know, I know you guys have had a big debate over school boundaries, and we've had the same thing here. I think I was the highest ranking public official, depending on how you count it. I'm not elected, but I believe I was the highest ranking public official in Montgomery County to endorse the boundary change study here. And surprisingly, I was not lit on fire and run out of town. So that was good. And I think we actually have made some progress on persuading people that that's not a threat to their property values or to their children's welfare. And I have to say the outgoing superintendent of schools frustrated me in a lot of ways. Jack Smith, my judgment would be that he had his heart in the right place. I'm not sure he moved quickly enough on a lot of issues. But on that one, I have to give him a lot of credit for seeing clearly that that was the right thing to do, and the school board really pushing that forward and being unflinching. And the fact that we had a recent school board election where the challengers who were trying to derail the boundary study were soundly defeated. In fact, the most prominent one came in distant third place. That was very helpful to showing that there is a political constituency for desegregating schools. And that's also helpful from the point of view of aligning school boundaries in a way that's more helpful to trying to manage real estate development in a way that aligns school capacity with the places where there's growth and where more people want to build housing. So that was actually a pleasant surprise that has worked out pretty well. It's not done yet, but I think we're making some progress. And I know you've kind of gone through some of the same issues in our
county. And we're about to do it again. It's just, it's going to come back around soon enough.
It is.
Probably too soon, whenever it happens. What is the best meal in Montgomery County? And this, so I'm going to give you a second to think, although you probably have an answer, because Montgomery County has me so jealous about food. Like, I had Moco Mike posting about Ethiopian food the other day. Like, I don't know. You guys have everything. So what's the best meal in Montgomery County that you can go out, I can go out and purchase?
There are a whole bunch. And, you know, I have to admit that I'm cheap. So my enjoyment of a meal is in inverse proportion to how much I paid for it. I would say our new headquarters moved to Wheaton, and we have some great restaurant options in Wheaton, some Vietnamese and Cambodian places like My Lai Khe in Wheaton is excellent. There are a couple of really good Thai places in Wheaton. Filippo's, which is an Italian deli that's literally across the alley from my office, just won a countywide contest for another leading blog that another leading blog ran for best deli in the county. So we have a lot of choices. I was a little bit disappointed that 8407 closed, which is in downtown Silver Spring, and it was taken over by Tacos, Tortillas, and Tequila, which is an excellent sort of a faux, you know, high-end Mexican place. But I have to admit that I miss 8407 and Jackie's, which unfortunately have gone the way of the dodo bird. But, you know, we've got a lot of places like, you know, Jackie still owns the Quarry House down the street. That's a great dive bar. And the Tater Tots are not to be missed.
All right.
If you come on down, we can do a food tour. I'm big into food, and I like to, you know, make the rounds. So I hope you'll take me up.
Yeah, and I actually think Andrew Friedson has also promised me a Montgomery County food tour. So maybe we can get both of you all together. And
yes, Andrew and I share a love of good food. And he'll do Bethesda backward and forward. But he's, even though he's a District 1 southwest part of the county kind of guy, he gets out to places like Burtonsville. We've got Cuba de Ayer, which is a great Cuban restaurant up there. We also have El Sapo, another great Cuban place in downtown Silver Spring. And I know, yeah, you can't go wrong in downtown Silver Spring or with Andrew Friedson.
Wait, I want to be on that show.
You can. You're invited. Come on down. We'll hook you up.
Don't know, we do like, you know, podcasters in a car. We're gonna do that one. Check it out. I think it's a great idea. We should totally do that. I'm gonna be like, Candace, please let me do that one.
All right, Annie, you want to land the plane?
Yeah. So last question is the same question. It is, what do you think we need to do to elevate Maryland?
Well, I think we need to be more focused on transit, getting transit infrastructure built in Montgomery County. That means, you know, getting the Purple Line done and then focusing on bus rapid transit. I think that bus rapid transit up 29 to Howard County would be a huge step forward for both counties. And I hope, you know, there's sort of a early start on that, which really needs to be improved to really make it high quality premium service, but we're getting there. And I think that if I were the governor, probably my main focus would be on transportation infrastructure, particularly transit, not just as a way to get people around, but also because transit exerts a gravitational pull on the land use pattern that occurs around it. If you build transit, then the tendency of real estate development is to cluster around those transit stops, and that creates higher quality places that are more walkable even and have more amenities and have a higher level of energy and excitement and are more attractive and therefore economically competitive, as well as supporting a high quality of life. And that's true even for people who never get on the transit, even the people that keep their cars. And so I think that would be my first thing on my agenda if I were thinking about, you know, statewide needs to try to fund more transit.
Wonderful. Well, we will be having some gubernatorial candidates on this show, and I promise you they will be asked about transit and land use. Thank you so much, Casey. This has been a great interview. Thank you for the work you're doing. As I say to many of my friends in Montgomery County, thank you all for having the in my opinion, high-minded conversation that you're having about land use and development so that you can inspire that conversation in other jurisdictions. I'm not obviously not saying everyone needs to have my view on land use and development, but I think that the conversation is a little bit healthier where you are than where it is here. And I think it's because of leaders like you that it has gotten that way. So thank you for coming on the show today.
Thanks. Well, this is why I was so excited to be on your show, because I think you're really leading the way to make those conversations happen all across the state. So I really appreciate that. I'm a big fan, and it's been a thrill.
All right. Thank you, Casey. All right. So we're now going to turn to our three things, which we're putting at the end of our show. The first one is going to be the ICE contract. While the state is continuing to evaluate whether or not it is going to end the contract with immigration enforcement across the entire state for our correctional institutions, Howard County has already decided that, or more directly, the county executive has already decided that he is going to end Howard County's contract with ICE. And we should remember that the county executive has already constrained that contract to be those that have pending criminal convictions for, I believe it's only for violent crime. As we've found over the discussion of canceling the contract, there are only 8 detainees there. And if you don't mind, I'm going to give my perspective, and then you can go. And Casey, you're welcome to pipe in if you stick around. I'm an attorney, for those that don't know. And one of my pro bono priority areas is immigration. I work with an organization called Kids in Need of Defense. It provides immigration counsel for juveniles, because one thing that's so unconscionable among many about our immigration system is that children do not have the right to an attorney and but for organizations like KIND, will appear by themselves in a courtroom with a attorney from Homeland Security, from Immigration Enforcement there on the other side that is saying all sorts of legal jargon, and there they are sitting there by themselves. So I care a lot about immigration enforcement. And now none of my clients are in ICE detention facilities, because oftentimes, if not always, but for this last president, the children are discharged into the care of guardians. But I do have a lot of friends that work representing detainees. And I'm going to sum it up, because this is already going long. This concerns me because it seems like we are just getting a bad problem outside of our boundaries without doing anything to solve it. And I am most concerned that these individuals are going to go to facilities that we have no control over, no eyeballs on. They're going to go to jurisdictions that have higher deportation rates. And we'll feel better, I guess, because we're not culpable for it anymore. But we did not reduce the suffering overall. And I think in our government decision-making, we should be working to reduce the suffering overall. And instead of making these facilities better, God forbid, pay more for our prisons to be better, kept better and better staffed and the like, we're just saying, get out. And you know, so what that the rest of our prisoners are going to continue under those conditions. But at least immigration detainees are not, because that is what we decided we are going to prioritize. So I'm not in love with it. I normally am a big fan of everything the county executive does. I think the county executive's hand was forced here. And I think that ultimately his original position is going to be validated, because we're going to have some follow-up coverage of what happens to detainees after they are expelled from the boundaries of Maryland, because our lawmakers decided that's what they needed to do. And it's not going to be a good story to read.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think you have a good point. And that's something where I don't know that they've actually gone through the ramifications of what that's going to look like. I think a lot of folks are, you're right, they're happy that it's the contract is done. But I will say, I mean, I'm not a big fan of ICE in general. And so I'm going to go a little bit bigger. And I'm going to say that I do hope Biden has the ability to really reform immigration. I think that as I think we need to really consider humanitarian aid and development aid in the countries like the Northern Triangle, where we have an influx of folks coming in right now. I think we need to do a better job of being the leader of the free world in a lot of ways, right? We shouldn't have ICE at all. ICE should not exist. It's not a function that we need. And I definitely don't think that we should have that at all. So that's kind of where I am. I realize that it's not entirely possible to get that done right now, but I do think that there's a possibility of it coming. And I do hope that that does happen. I think we have to look at the upstream issues on this as opposed to the downstream effects. What I don't think they're doing is necessarily looking at the downstream effects of what they're doing right mm-hmm. now, which is, you know, moving the facilities or making sure the facilities are elsewhere. So but I hear you and I'm interested to see how this goes.
Yeah. Yeah. The next topic we're going to discuss, and we spent a lot of time talking about housing policy, so we don't need to talk about it much more, but I put on the list to discuss the editorial. I was very excited to see it published in the Baltimore Sun. I've been honored with the reception that it has had in the Twitterverse in particular. But what has been most exciting is the elected officials that have reached out to me and getting to talk to them. I guess there's not much else to say on it other than I was really scared about writing this thing, because oftentimes I feel like my views on housing are seen as extremist positions. I mean, and that's on their best day. On most days, they're seen as fully funded by the development industry. My clients are paying me, I suppose, a surcharge for my ideas. Maybe I'm on the clock now based on these theories.
You're on the clock 24 hours a day.
I know. Tom. Even when I'm sleeping and my brain is resting from thinking about greedy developers all day. But, you know, instead of just considering that I do this because I care about housing, but that would be too charitable. It's exciting. It's exciting. And, you know, it's one editorial. A week from now, people are going to forget it was ever there. But I do hope that we can continue to pursue some of these ideas, contest these ideas. I think Casey said before, you know, it's an argument. An argument is only as good as its ability to persuade. But yeah, I mean, that's my pitch. Read the editorial if you haven't already. We already posted it on the Facebook page, so check it out.
Yeah. No, I think ideas, we often don't have ideas that come out into the public realm. And if it's not written down, it doesn't, sometimes I feel like if things aren't written down, they don't actually happen. And so I think this is a great way to get your ideas, especially on housing, out into the public forum. They start conversations, and those conversations do go to other places. I think it's great that elected officials are reaching out to you. I think that that does in a lot of ways show that what you're saying makes sense. And so I'm excited about it too. I think it's great. I'm really glad that you wrote it. It was very well written. I was impressed in general, but I think it's
a lot of help. What are you thinking about?
I didn't edit. I didn't
edit. What are you thinking about, Annie?
So I guess what I'm thinking about is our vaccinations right now, because I think I've read a few different articles recently about vaccinations and how people are avoiding getting vaccinations. Not because they don't actually believe in it. They do believe in vaccinations, but they want to make sure that they are getting them. They're letting everyone else go first. And there's no doubt that we should be going by phase. There's no doubt that we need to follow those guidelines. But once your phase is in, once your phase is within the guidelines of the state that you're in or the location, the jurisdiction you're in, you should go. Don't wait. Don't make it like, oh, you know, like I feel okay, I'll be fine. As soon as your phase is up, you should go and you should get vaccinated. There's a plan. There's a general, we want to get back to normal. And they are doing, I know in some locations, some of the mass vax locations, they're doing 4,000 vaccinations a day. Just go. as soon as you're ready, make your appointment and get on your, get on the waiting list or the list that you have to be on where the county will tell you that your phase is ready. Get on the list. Just start.
Yes. Good advice, because I am seeing many people that there's got to be a term for it. By the time this is done, there will be a term for seeing someone else hold up their vaccination card and you looking at them being like, where did you fit in the phase? What exactly, you 25-year-old personal trainer, what are you doing now? But yeah, let's everybody go and do that, because I think any of us that are connected in any way have had someone say to us, oh, well, I can get you vaccinated. No, I just use this link. And many of us are standing by, and standing by only makes sense if those of you that are eligible and your number is called are going and getting it. And I want to emphasize and underline what Annie had said. If you go to Howard County's website, which I think is howardcountymd.gov, there is a, you can sign on for this notification system where it, they will contact you and tell you when it is time, to get your vaccine. So if you're curious, if you're trying to follow the Baltimore Sun or Governor Hogan's press conferences, don't do that. Just go ahead and work with the local health authority and they will let you know. And I think, Annie, you actually also wanted to address an enticement that has been offered for getting vaccinated.
Yes. I can't myself do this because I can't eat donuts, but if I could, I would. Krispy Kreme is actually offering a donut to anyone who shows their vaccination card, which there will be a word for. You're right, Tom. There will be, I don't know what it's going to be called.
It's going to be some German type of word. It's going to be a really long word.
It's got to be a portmanteau of something, but I don't know what, but hopefully it's something good. But they are giving away a donut to people who show their vaccination card. And I think other businesses should try that too. I think it's a great idea. So I'm excited to see what's offered locally. I'm definitely hoping for some bakeries and maybe some ice cream places.
You can create herd immunity in your restaurant if you just say, yes. Hey, you know, we've got a deal for vaccinated people to come in here. So maybe you unvaccinated people can get a special section in the restaurant, enjoying your subhuman status for the moment. That's not right. I shouldn't have said that. But yes, so everybody get vaccinated, and hopefully a couple months from now, we will have vaccinated hosts and we can return to our live location, which is one of the most fun things about doing the show. But I'm not gonna get too far ahead. All right. Well, this has been a fantastic show. Thank you, Annie, for stepping in for Candace again. Thank you to our guest, Casey Anderson. And we'll see you all in a couple weeks when I think we'll be talking about cicadas. All right. Take care, everybody.